We have been in an area in debate about this for so long that the uncertainty in the industry has led to an investment strike. Apart from renewable generation under the renewable energy target, there's been no new plant built, either pumped hydro or gas or coal, and there's a real need for everybody who's investing to just look at the types of generation we need going forward and for that investment adjustment to occur.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. The government last week finally released its energy plan. This is based on retailers having to meet two requirements. The first is for them to deliver a certain level of reliable, so-called dispatchable, power, which comes from sources such as coal and gas. The second is to contribute through renewable energy to meeting Australia's international emissions reduction obligations. The plan was devised by the Energy Security Board, which reports to both federal and state governments. We have with us today Kerry Schott, the chair of that board, who came to the position with a wealth of experience in both the public and private sector. Kerry Schott, this plan is directed to delivering reliable and affordable energy, as well as helping to meet Australia's international commitments to emissions reduction. To which of these does it give priority, or do they all have equal standing?
Michelle, they have equal standing in the sense that they must be linked. And the reason for that is that emissions reduction is in part driven by more renewables provided by solar and wind. And both of those types of generations are intermittent. So when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining, there must be a reliable power to be dispatched, and that's why they both need to go together. It's a how you balance introducing more intermittent renewables with reliability is an issue that electricity systems everywhere in the world are focused on at the moment.
So it's really reliability that's at the top of the heap, is it?
Well, it's reliability in the sense of keeping the lights on is basically down to physics. If you've got intermittent power, you must have some sort of power that you can dispatch when there's a sudden change in wind or a sudden clouds go over. You just cannot have 100% provided by intermittent renewables.
Perhaps inevitably this issue very quickly bogged down in terms of what modelling there was to show that your conclusions all stacked up. The government's now asked your board to produce modelling by the middle of next month to back the proposal, but why didn't you get this detailed modelling done before the plan's release?
The reason for that was that really a lack of time. The board was appointed following a recommendation from the Finkel Review, and the board appointments commenced about the middle of August, so we haven't been there for very long, and in the time we had available, we did what we could do. The numbers that have been around are based on previous analysis that the Australian Energy Market Commission have done, and they've done a lot of general work in this area and can come up with numbers that are reasonable. What we're doing now is modelling the precise recommendation that we've made.
It's been a bit confusing. Even though it wasn't your modelling, there has been some modelling done that underpins this work. Is that right, or is there no modelling at all?
There's been a lot of work done on different sorts of scenarios, but not exactly on the reliability and emissions guarantee that underpinned what advice we gave.
Now, you mentioned the Finkel review.
Yes.
I think that many people are really confused after the government seemed for a while quite enthusiastic, or at least the Prime Minister, about the clean energy target, and then we've moved on to the board's plan. Could you just briefly outline why this plan is better than the clean energy target would have been?
Look, I wouldn't say it was better. And if you have a look at Alan Finkel's report, he has a number of ways in which to get emissions reduction and is relatively agnostic about the route that you take. The important thing, and one that the Finkel review emphasised, was to have an orderly transition from the sort of system we've got now to where we need to get to with far more renewables. And what we've done in our work, which I think is very important, is to link the emissions reduction with the reliability requirement. And if you think about it, it's actually quite a simple requirement, because in detail it's not simple, but you just cannot have an energy system that's reliant on huge amounts of wind and solar without backup that can come on when it's required.
The next hurdle for this plan is obviously the states, getting the states' cooperation. And we've seen the Labor states being quite critical. Your board will clearly have an important role in trying to persuade the states. Have you begun that persuasion work?
We've had a meeting with state officials, and there's a COAG meeting in November which will discuss this issue amongst others. But can I say that the advice, it's important to separate out policy advice of the kind that we're giving from policy that the government sets. And what the government's set, whether it's the Commonwealth or the states, is an emissions reduction that suits their jurisdiction and their voters. The Commonwealth government has an international obligation, and they required us to take that into account when giving them advice. The other jurisdictions, the states, will have different emissions reduction targets, if I can put it like that, or I expect they will. There is no reason why that can't be accommodated in what we've recommended, because the essence of what we've recommended is that whatever emissions reduction you go for, you must ensure sufficient backup reliability.
So what you're saying is the scheme could be modified to, for example, include more renewables if the states wanted that?
Yes, exactly.
And how would that work? Would the scheme then vary between the states?
The emissions target could vary between the states, and if, depending on where their emissions target is, that will dictate within their regions what reliability they need. So that would vary also between the jurisdictions.
And how would that flow through to retailers and to consumers?
Well, the retailers are each of the states for terms of retail offerings basically operates as a state which is connected to other states with interconnectors, but the retailers would have to balance their loads for their customers in each of the states. Now, that sounds complicated on the face of it, but it is exactly what they do now. So in each of the states, they now get their load together from different generators, and they would continue to do that. But in doing so, they would have to meet the emissions target in that state, and they would also have to meet the physical requirement for reliability in that state.
So given this potential for flexibility, are you optimistic that in the end an agreement will be reached on this scheme?
I hope so, Michelle, because we have been in an area in debate about this for so long that the uncertainty in the industry has led to an investment strike. Apart from renewable generation under the renewable energy target, there's been no new plant built, either pumped hydro or gas or coal. And there's a real need for everybody who's investing to just look at the types of generation we need going forward and for that investment adjustment to occur.
Presumably this flexibility, which you're talking about between the states, could also mean that the federal opposition could embrace the general framework of this scheme and then add on some more ambitious target or targets.
They could do that, yes.
So that would, if that happened and the next election was fought along those lines,
yes,
that, do you think, would give reasonable certainty for investors? They could look at going in to the period ahead, knowing whichever government was in power, whichever side was in power, there was a fairly solid, predictable framework.
Yes. The international commitments that the Commonwealth government makes are basically binary across everyone, because that's an international commitment that's been made, and both and whatever the form of government, the country is committed to that. But if the incoming, if an incoming Labor government, say, wanted to increase the emissions target, they could do that.
And the scheme would operate in general as you've outlined?
It would operate in general as outlined. What would happen if there's an increase in the emissions reduction is that there would be a compensatory adjustment in reliability in different jurisdictions. It may not change the reliability requirements in every state. It just depends where everybody is at any given point in time.
If reasonable agreement can't be reached, on the other hand, what is the outlook for investment? How dire will the situation become?
Well, the situation is dire, and I think
already,
and that would continue. And what we would see is an ongoing lack of capacity, which would be made worse as existing coal-fired plants retire. And we've got to keep in mind that the existing coal fleet is a depreciating fleet. Some of it is quite old. And I think the newest plants would be due to retire in the mid-2040s, which sounds a long way out, but in terms of long investment horizons, isn't actually that far away. But a lot of plant will be due to retire before that, and we really must have sufficient reliable and dispatchable capacity to replace those retiring fleets.
So you're really saying this is the last throw of the dice, that if there's not agreement around a scheme like this, then we're going to have more shortages of power, more blackouts, and ever-increasing prices?
Well, that's a pretty likely alternative. It's really not one that anybody wants to face, and I can't imagine that any government of whatever persuasion would want to go down that route. So you've got to think that there's got to be a solution to these issues, and if this is not the solution, then sitting here at the moment, I don't know what is, but we've got to get through this and just get over this issue and get on so that investment can occur.
So you're saying the plan really has political self-interest on both sides, on its side?
Oh, it's got political self-interest, but it's also got consumer interest for both households and business.
What do you make of this week's Productivity Commission call for a price on carbon? And is this scheme, in fact, a price on carbon?
No, this scheme is not a price on carbon. It's using existing market mechanisms to allow an emissions reduction target to be set and then for reliability to adjust. I think that the Productivity Commission work follows the price on carbon sort of policy measures that have been around for a long time. And the principal issue about those for Australia is that it has become politically unacceptable.
Now, some commentators say that this plan heralds a resumption of government intervention in a previously free market energy sector. Does this mean privatisation has failed to deliver energy security? Has privatisation really been one of the problems here?
No, I don't think it's privatisation that's the issue. It's been the uncertainty in the market. And this advice that we gave is actually based on existing market mechanisms. So it really isn't government interfering in the market, excepting that it is government and it is their role to set emissions reductions targets. And that is really not the role of anybody in the electricity industry, or the role of my board. That's a government role to set that target. But what we're saying is that once that's set, then there's a requirement for dispatchable energy that's needed, and that's basically the requirement that we've followed. But I would stress it uses the existing market mechanisms. It's not anti-market and it's not encouraging government interference beyond setting the emissions requirement.
You were asked in a recent interview on Late Line about the savings for households and businesses and whether these could be guaranteed. And you said, I don't think that anybody can guarantee a price reduction about anything because what happens with prices depends on too many things. Do you think in retrospect that the board was unwise to say that this could represent a saving for households of up to $115 a year in their power bills? Should you have not actually used a figure?
No, I don't think so. I think with the advice that we've given, an obvious question is, so what is that going to do to wholesale and retail bills and prices? And so on the basis of analysis that's been done over the last few years by the Energy Market Commission, we were happy to give those numbers. But what I was getting at in the Late Line interview was that electricity prices that we all get in our bills are made up of a number of things, and one of the major components of them, for example, is the cost of distribution, poles and wires, which is actually one of the main drivers behind the price increases that many of us have experienced. And the other big driver in there is the cost of gas and coal. And while those things may vary, you know, the prices will vary, but what we were doing with those numbers was just trying to suggest what would happen with this being introduced and just holding everything as it, you know, constant as it is at the moment. Those things may change more favourably, or in fact they may change, you know, unfavourably.
But whenever you talk about numbers going out years and years, it's fairly meaningless, isn't it? So even the modelling that we're about to get, which would produce presumably more precise numbers, all depends on the assumptions fed in and probably doesn't mean a lot in the longer run, does it?
Well, it does depend on the assumptions fed in, but it does tell you some information that's very helpful. So for the advice that we gave, it tells you whether it's likely to lead to a price reduction, and if so, you know, roughly what size. What I was getting at with my comments before was that gas and coal prices can change, and that could change the outcome, and the regulated cost of poles and wires can change also. So I must say we don't anticipate that that will happen because there's just been a very large increase in that.
I wonder if I could just turn briefly at the end to the issue of the NBN, which has been very much in the news this week. You're an NBN director. It's currently under a lot of pressure with customer complaints and questioning of its financial viability. How do you see the future of the NBN? Should we be really worried about where it's up to? It does seem suboptimal at the moment. And what's the message that you'd give to consumers?
Well, on matters NBN, I'd really rather leave that to the chairman and CEO to respond to. But what I would say about those two general issues that we're very aware of the difficulties that customers have been facing with their connections and activation, and that is not entirely an NBN issue. It is also and in large part often an issue with the retailer, the Telstra, Optus, TPGs of the world. So you've got a complicated situation where NBN is putting in the broadband part of the connection, but then the connection into the house, and then what happens in the house or business largely is determined by the retailer that you're using. So these things all have to be coordinated and work well together. And it's not simple. We're very conscious of it and we're doing everything we can to make it better. There have been an increase in the number of complaints, but when you think that we are connecting every premise in Australia to this network and we are now doing a rollout that's going quite rapidly, it's not a surprise really that we're struggling, and by we I mean the retailers as well as NBN, struggling to be 100% perfect with everything. But we do take these complaints very seriously and are working on correcting it. On the matter of financial viability, I am confident that NBN is financially viable, but what I would draw attention to is that we have an obligation to service the entire country. And once you get past the population density in our cities, the cost of servicing each premise is very expensive. And this is something that Australia, because of its geography, always grapples with, because we think it's very important that everybody, wherever they live, has an adequate level of service. And that means that someone has to subsidise the very expensive connections, and sometimes the government does that out of general revenue, and sometimes, as with NBN, you do it by sharing the cost across all your customers. We can do that, but the issue that we then face is that mobile, which to an increasing extent is a competitor of ours, doesn't get to carry the parts of the bush that they're not worrying about doing business with. So it's a universal obligation issue and who pays for it.
Kerry Schott, thank you very much for talking with us today. You're involved in two very complex policy areas and it's been great getting your views. That's all from the Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back with another interview very soon.